This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Friday, January 24th. Day two of the House impeachment manager's opening arguments happened to focus on a major topic of a new book by two journalists who've been following the impeachment process very closely, but were asking this question long before the Ukraine scandal broke in September. We'll talk in a minute to the authors, Susan Hennessy and Benjamin Wittes. In their new book, they say the most novel propositions of the Trump presidency are placing the personal dimensions of the office over everything else, and that civic virtue doesn't matter. So last night in the trial, Adam Schiff put it plainly in his closing remarks.
You can't trust this president to do what's right for this country. You can trust he will do what's right for Donald Trump.
Adam Schiff last night. Here's one more example, shocking and stark. They played a clip of Trump's former Russia expert, Fiona Hill, from her testimony in the House hearings. In this clip, she's describing how back in the summer, she didn't understand how Trump Ambassador Gordon Sondland seemed to be running a secret Ukraine foreign policy of his own.
So I was upset with him that he wasn't fully telling us about all of the meetings that he was having. And he said to me, but I'm briefing the president. I'm briefing Chief of Staff Mulvaney. I'm briefing Secretary Pompeo, and I've talked to Ambassador Bolton. Who else do I have to deal with? And the point is, we have a robust interagency process that deals with Ukraine. It includes Mr. Holmes. It includes Ambassador Taylor as the chargé in Ukraine. It includes a whole load of other people. But it struck me when yesterday, when you put up on the screen Ambassador Sondland's emails and who was on these emails, and he said, these are the people who need to know, that he was absolutely right. Because he was being involved in a domestic political errand. And we were being involved in national security foreign policy. And those two things had just diverged.
Fiona Hill from the House hearings, as played in the Senate impeachment trial last night. Actual U.S. policy toward Ukraine and a domestic political errand for Trump had diverged, and the domestic political errand ranked higher. With that, let's welcome Susan Hennessy, executive editor, and Benjamin Wittes, editor-in-chief of the website Lawfare, which describes itself as covering hard national security choices. Their new book is called Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Susan and Ben, we appreciate your work and your time today. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
And let's start on this news. Am I right to say that yesterday's central argument in the impeachment trial intersects with the central theme of your book?
Very much so. So, you know, the thesis of the book is to present Donald Trump's vision of the presidency and to evaluate it and critique it. And our argument essentially is that this vision of the presidency, A, really is a vision, and B, is a dangerous vision. And one of the things that we were really struck by as the book was going to press and the Ukraine scandal broke was the degree to which his conduct in this scandal really highlighted all of the major components of the thesis that we had articulated. And the book was written before the Ukraine scandal. We wrote a little postscript to deal with it. But I do think that there is a real thematic consistency between the vision of the presidency that we articulate in the book and the thing that he is being impeached and tried for now.
And we'll talk both about Ukraine and some non-Ukraine examples. But let me get you to separate a couple of things. You refer to Trump placing the personal and expressive dimensions of the presidency, those are your words, personal and expressive, above all else, but also his most novel proposition that civil virtue doesn't matter. So let's take each of these. What do you mean by personal and expressive dimensions of the presidency?
Yeah, so as we were writing this book, we were trying to be really, really disciplined as a historical matter. You know, whenever we look at these norms that Donald Trump is violating on a near daily basis, you know, it's not accurate to say all of it is unprecedented. In fact, the presidency is a changeable institution, and it's changed a lot over time. But there are things about Donald Trump that are genuinely new and novel, and this sense of using the office sort of in this personal, expressive sense is something we actually haven't seen before. And that's that the president, through his actions, doesn't appear to be all that concerned with the day-to-day management of the federal government, which is, of course, the actual job of the president of the United States. Instead, he's interested in sort of declaring his opinions or his intentions or his moods, and then expecting the federal government to conform itself, to essentially creating that reality. And we see that play out in a lot of really interesting and fascinating and quite scary ways along different dimensions of executive power.
And so that's not necessarily just corrupt, but do you see the Ukraine example as a case where it becomes corrupt because of what Fiona Hill so clearly described in that clip, our foreign policy and national security policy toward Ukraine being altered for the cause of the domestic political errand of smearing Joe Biden?
Yeah, so the core of the Trumpian expressive presidency is the sublimation of all of the basic functions of the office, the management functions, the public service functions, to the personal interests of the office holder, right? And the personal expressive interests, as Susan just said, but also the financial interests, the political interests. And the Ukraine scandal highlights this in a very dramatic set of ways. So it is the abuse of law enforcement for personal reasons, in this case not domestic law enforcement, which he also does, but Ukrainian law enforcement, right? It is the highly impulsive conduct of foreign policy outside of the normal foreign policy process that is supposed to inform presidential decision making. And the debate, the presentations yesterday from the House managers really highlighted that point. It is the belief that it is legitimate to use the power of the office to reward friends and punish enemies. And all of these things that we talk about in the book and we try to disaggregate in the book come together in this scandal in a fashion that is, dramatically corrupt, and corrupt in the very core, which is it is not the specific acts that he's taking. It's the total absence of public interest and the replacement of that with his own interest behind everything he did in this scandal.
What's another non-Ukraine example of this personal expressive dimension of the presidency being elevated under Trump?
Yeah, so we saw this in the earliest days. So, there's an example really from the very first days that Donald Trump was in office. And that's that, he swears the oath to become the commander-in-chief of the United States, the most powerful office in the world, and certainly in the democratic world, and immediately turns. And what does he become obsessed with and focused on? The size of the crowds at his inauguration. And the National Park Service retweets an image that shows Barack Obama's inaugural crowds next to Donald Trump's, and it shows that Obama's crowds are bigger. So later reporting shows that Donald Trump personally directs the Interior Secretary to fix it and to stop these accounts from tweeting. Now, the National Park Service actually uses Twitter for emergency communications to tell people about flood routes and mudslides, right? Sort of the ordinary job of the government. But Donald Trump doesn't care about that, right? He cares about crowd size. And so he says, stop tweeting. And so we have an executive branch that might be sort of bewildered that the president could care about something so silly, so petty, so plainly not in the national interest, but in his own personal interest of ego. But the executive branch isn't structured to ignore that, sort of the silly whims of the president, and so it has to carry them out. And so what we see is this merging of a president who is putting powers that are designed to serve the national interest to his own purposes, and that's having a really corrosive effects over the long term, and in ways both very minor and in really profound and long term.
What about this most novel idea of his presidency, as you call it, that civic virtue doesn't matter? What a thing to even say without shuddering at the thought. But what do you mean by civic virtue doesn't matter?
All right. So the American constitutional experiment is based on two great protections against falling apart. One, which we talk about all the time, is structural separation of powers, the idea that you create checks and balances inherent in the system so that one person doesn't gather too much power. But the other one, which was super important to the founders and is embedded in the Constitution in the form of requirements that people take oaths of office, is this idea that you're going to have enlightened people and you're going to have mechanisms to choose enlightened, serious people who have a sense of the public good and who publicly swear to pursue the public good. And that is one of the ways you're going to prevent them from using their office, say, to line their own pockets. The presidential oath of office is the one place in the Constitution that uses quotation marks. The founders took it so seriously that they literally scripted what the office holder is going to say. And the reason for that is you cannot force a president to be a good commander in chief. You cannot force a president to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The most you can do is make him or her publicly promise to try to do those things. And what Donald Trump does is he comes in and he doesn't pretend for a moment to be a public interested sort of guy. He, you know, openly says if he doesn't pay taxes, that makes him smart. He openly says, sort of wildly contemptuous things about what we would think of as normal good government. And when he swears this oath of office, tens of millions of people around the country look at it and say, he doesn't mean a word of that. He doesn't even know what those mean. And that is a profound change. Prior presidents who have been bad people, who've lacked virtue, they fake it. And that's the homage that vice pays to virtue. And Donald Trump, to his credit, he is not a hypocrite. But the result is a presidency that stands for the idea that the oath doesn't really mean anything and that civic virtue does not, in fact, underlie the conduct of the presidency.
Maybe the most shocking thing is that for a third or more of the country, they either like this tossing civic virtue overboard or they don't find it disqualifying. How new or shocking do you find that?
Oh, I find it very shocking. I think actually one of the most important things about the Trump presidency is the degree to which it shows that for a very large percentage of the population does not actually hold what we call the traditional presidency in high regard. And by the way, that is a message that I think we need to take very seriously, that lots of things that we look at and say these are important norms, these are important standards of behavior seem to very many Americans like hypocrisy and pomp and a kind of fake silliness. And Trump lies about a million things all the time. But, you know, his pulling the mask off of that is actually, that comes off to a huge number of people as authentic and honest, because at some level it is.
And it also must mean that the status quo pre-Trump was failing a lot of people.
Absolutely.
I tend to think we wouldn't be in an impeachment trial today were it not that Trump fired Comey and admitted on TV and boasted to the Russian ambassador that he got the Russia thing off his back by firing Comey. That was the original abuse of power and personalization of the office, and everything flowed from there, I think. I'm curious how much you agree.
Yeah, so I certainly don't think that it was the original abuse of power, because I think we saw actually a number of substantive abuses before that, including, of course, asking this loyalty oath, asking for Comey to pressure to let Mike Flynn go, the failure to divest from his personal businesses. Right. So I think we saw a lot before. But I actually do think the firing of the FBI director tells us something really interesting about how Trump might change the office of the presidency moving forward. If we don't really take the idea idea seriously, that he is putting a vision on the table, that we have to decide whether or not to ratify, not in these impeachment proceedings, but actually in the 2020 election itself. So the FBI director, there's a law that the FBI director serves a 10-year term. Now, no one doubts that the president has the constitutional right to fire an FBI director. That's sort of part of his role as the head of the executive branch. But we want this idea of independent law enforcement. So Trump comes in and he fires the FBI director, and nothing happens. There's no consequence for that. Now, the next president will come in either in 2021 or 2025, and that person will have to make a decision too. They could look at Chris Wray, the current FBI director, and say, well, he seems like a perfectly nice guy. He's doing a perfectly fine job, but I want my own person in the office.
Or Trump got away with all these things and there were no consequences. So
exactly. And they could then decide, well, I've seen that a president can fire the FBI director and essentially make him a political appointee. So I'm going to do the same thing. And what would happen then is the expectation that a president doesn't fire an FBI director, that norm would be gone forever. And so, you know, we should really take seriously not just what President Trump is doing and why, but whether or not we actually care about these things and care about these things in the future and with new and different presidents.
I wonder about how narrowly the House Democrats have made this about Ukraine. What it's really about, I think, is Trump's serial abuse of power and attempted obstruction of justice 10 times over during the Mueller investigation, and deprofessionalizing the government against the public interest in all the ways your book is about. But we're not hearing the larger context, just the individual alleged misconduct having to do with Ukraine. Do you have that impression at all?
Well, so at one level, I do. Susan in particular went on a bit of a crusade as the House was drafting the impeachment articles to have them include a specific article about the Mueller obstruction allegation, one particular of them, with which I very much agreed. That said, so when you look at it narrowly, what they're talking about, yeah, they're talking about one specific episode, and yet your first question today was the themes that they are talking about are the themes of this book. And that suggests to me that perhaps actually by focusing in on this one case study of the abuse, they are actually managing to capture the larger thematic notion, and that this case is standing for a class of cases. So I can argue it both ways. When I sat down to say, okay, what are the articles of impeachment I would have wanted to see, we wrote a post that suggested there should be five of them. There are only two. So I would have written it more broadly.
Since you're the one, Susan, who went on that crusade to get them to include the other stuff, are you sufficiently satisfied that they're doing what they need to do now?
So I'm sufficiently impressed watching the House managers present a case over the past 2 or 3 days that there was strategic value in this choice, and that's being able to see the clarity of narrative and the ability to present a clean single case to the American public. There's real value in that, and the countervailing risk, of course, is by not impeaching for certain things, that itself is a choice. It's a choice to declare something not impeachable. And so right now, I think it was clearly the correct strategic choice in terms of presenting a case before the Senate. It would have been vastly more complicated if there was charge related to Robert Mueller. That said, I do think we have to think about a world in which the president is probably inevitably acquitted of this, whether or not that choice to say or not say, meeting the statutory elements of criminal obstruction of justice, which of course the Mueller report effectively finds that the president did, not impeaching for that, is saying that it's not impeachable, and that will have consequences.
So let me play one more clip from yesterday that goes directly to national security choices, and it's in the articles of impeachment. Article 1 says, President Trump used the powers of the presidency in a manner that compromised the national security of the United States. So here again is Adam Schiff.
The Kremlin showed boldly in 2016 that with the malign skills it honed in Ukraine, they would not stay in Ukraine. Instead, Russia employed them here to attack our institutions, and they will do so again. Indeed, They've never stopped. Will we allow the primary country now fighting Russia to be weakened, placing our troops in Europe at greater risk and opening the door to greater interference in our affairs at home?
And this was supposed to be a central argument here, and it's there on paper, like I read from Article 1, but I don't tend to think it's landing out there, that people are feeling less safe in Pennsylvania or Wisconsin or Michigan as opposed to only less safe in Ukraine. Do you?
You know, I agree with you. The first place, to my knowledge, that anybody made the argument that Donald Trump posed a national security threat was actually John Bellinger, who was the State Department's legal advisor in the Bush administration. And he made this argument early in the campaign on lawfare. And a few months later, I guess it was in March 2016, I took that idea and I tried to elaborate it. What was it about this campaign that was, from my point of view, threatening to national security? So it is at one level a matter of some gratification to see that that actual argument is central in the in these articles of impeachment. We flagged it, both John and I, early in the campaign before he was elected. And part of the reason was some of the themes that show up in these articles. That said, I completely agree with you. And the national security threat that he is posing is hard to explain to people. It is hard to explain why the erosion of the idea of non-foreign interference in our campaigns is a deeply threatening one. It is hard to explain to people why we are less safe if the president encourages or tolerates incursions into countries with which we have strategic partnerships with by adversary forces. And it is hard to explain to people how large armies of Russian troll bots actually make them less safe because they undermine the quality of the information that they receive. All of that is true. All of that is real. All of that is a big, big problem. And the president is encouraging all of it. And yet that is hard to explain to people. And so I'm not surprised that the impeachment managers have focused on other components of it. I do think it is an important thing for them to have stated as baldly as they stated it.
Benjamin Wittes, editor-in-chief, and Susan Hennessy, executive editor of the website Lawfare. Their new book is called Unmaking the Presidency: Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Again, listeners, you can call and ask an impeachment news question. Just leave a voicemail anytime, including your name and where you're calling from, and some of you will hear your questions on the show. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-TALK or 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.